Erev Tov, Bruchim Habayim, welcome. Thank you to our host, thank you to everyone for coming, and a special thank you to Rabbi Danishevsky, who I have the privilege of knowing for quite some time. More than 20 years ago, you could say, when he was in high school and I was in YU, we were in the same chabura.
That's a little bit charitable.
That's the fact.
I was a student and Rand was the Rebbe.
Well, we were the same chabura. And then since we came to Chicago, he has helped the Kollel nurture our initiative to work beyond the Orthodox community. And since then, he has gone on to influence and inspire and heal so many individuals, I would say, in the concentric circles of our community, in expanding orbit, in the mind-body therapy. But tonight, we're going to focus on his work as an author and as a teacher of this magnificent new book called Attached, Connecting to Our Creator, a Jewish Psychological Approach, which you can find conveniently located right there on the table, and you can procure your own copy, which you certainly will want. And I'm excited to share this conversation because it'll be an opportunity for me to hear from behind the scenes of the author. Part of what I'm curious is, what didn't make it into the book? Was there something like specific that you wanted to put in that you didn't put in there? But for those who are not familiar, the theme of this work is attachment. It's the notion of relationships. And for some of us, that means rethinking our approach to Yiddishkeit, to Judaism, to the Ribono Shel Olam, to God, in light of this idea of relationships. So maybe we'll put off what you left on the cutting room floor for a minute, but one of the things that struck me about the book is that you reflect a little bit on your own journey. And maybe take a moment just to express and explain to all of us how significant it is for a person to view their life as a journey, and specifically their spiritual life as a journey, because that's definitely a theme that goes throughout the book.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great question. So before I respond to the question, just quickly also want to thank Rev Rand for organizing this and having me in this opportunity. We've shared a lot of different experiences together, and it's always a pleasure. And I also want to thank the Pimshots. Dov is actually one of the earliest readers of a much earlier version manuscript of the book. Maybe the first, I'm not sure. Maybe one, definitely first few. Dov had to suffer through a much longer version because what editors do and the publishers did is you asked what I leave out. I left out like half of what I initially wrote. Dov actually read the whole awfully tangential, winding thing that had so many probably irrelevant and tangential detours. But so it's great to be here. So the idea of being on a journey, it's so interesting you bring that up, because just this Friday night, I have the opportunity to speak at what we call the Shtiebel Minyan in West Rogers Park on Friday nights. And what I commented on there was that it struck me for the first time that the very opening of Sefer Shmos that we just concluded, right? We just finished the book of Exodus, Sefer Shmos, the very opening psukim and the very last psukim are both about traveling. They're about how the Jewish people travel. I never noticed that before. The very first pasuk is about the Jewish people traveling into Mitzrayim. And the very last pasuk is about Hashem telling B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, how do you travel in the wilderness with the Mishkan? And how do you know when to travel based on the cloud and the fire, etc.? So the bookends of the book are about traveling. And maybe it's connected to the idea, I don't know, but maybe it's connected to the idea of the book being called Shmos, which is names. And the idea is that we develop our name, we develop our identity, who we are, through our travels. And that's why the book that's about having a name, having an identity, is bookended by traveling, because we're always moving, we're always traveling. I think it's really interesting that in the Zohar HaKadosh, the great work of Jewish, of Kabbalah, so often the secrets that are revealed, that are talked about when the Tanaim are traveling on the road. It's like always stories, like they're on the road and they bump into Hahu Yanuka, a child, or they bump into some elderly person, or they bump into someone who tells them something, or they're in the middle of traveling and then all of a sudden Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, whoever it is, has some great revelation to share. But they're always traveling. I think I saw this observation initially in a book called A River Flows from Eden. I don't remember the author's name, but a fascinating book. And it's just about this idea that they're always traveling when things come out. And there's so many different ways that you can go with that, and the significance of traveling, of Shmos being bookended by traveling, and in the Zohar and the Gemara too, really, so often they're traveling, right? It wasn't always the way we typically think of sitting in a base medrash and learning, or there was a lot of traveling, a lot of movement. But I think to me what it means is the idea of staying in a stance of curiosity, staying in a place of the unknown. And we value, I think it's very natural to value knowledge and certainty. There's a great podcast called Faith Garden, I think, right? Talks about that we naturally have a tendency to be interested in having a sense of certainty and clarity and knowledge. But I think that in many ways, certainty is actually overrated because it makes things very constricted, very boxed, very final and complete. And curiosity is really what allows for things to continue developing, for things to allow to always have a freshness and an openness, whether that's in personal relationships between one person and another, or it's in our relationship with Hashem, to be in a place of not knowing, because ultimately, we really never know. We really never know. There's actually a statement that goes way back to the Kadmonim. We don't know exactly who the first person who said it was, because it gets quoted in a number of places. The Rashba quotes it already, but from earlier sources, and Rabbi Nachman of Breslov makes a big focus on this. It says, "Tachlas hayedia sheyeda shelo yeda." The purpose of all knowledge is to know that you can't know. So every time you learn something, you learn more. But each time you learn something and you know more, what just revealed itself is the next layer of what you don't know. And then when you learn that layer and you understand it, so now the next layer becomes unknown again, and that's an endless process. And the idea there is profound if you think about that in the context of relationships with other people, because that means that I could be married now for, I think, I have no idea. Is this being recorded? I can't remember now. 12 years maybe, I think, 12, I think. And what that means is that however much I know my wife, there's still a lot that I don't know. And that's exciting. That's what allows a relationship to be fresh, to be just as meaningful in some ways and as when you're first getting to know somebody. It's exciting because there's something new that you don't know. And so I don't know pieces of myself yet, and so that's exciting. And I don't know things about my wife yet, and that's exciting. And I definitely don't know a whole lot about God, and so that's exciting. And so that means that life can be constantly dynamic and moving, and I think that's an important part of it.
But I think the premise that's baked into that, which I don't want to gloss over because I think it's an important thing for us to focus on, is that as part of this journey, the description that you gave of the box is important to identify, because very often a person saw themselves at one stage in their lives in a particular box, right? You describe it in the book. At one point you were, you know, in the Rabbi Sachs box, you could say, right? And now you are in a different place. Now, obviously those experiences have shaped you, but they didn't define you.
Right.
And so moving from being defined to being shaped and influenced, that I think is a big part of this idea of the journey, that for many of us, we had a particular approach to Judaism, whether we had that because it's what our parents gave us, our school gave us, some book gave us, wherever that came from, we had a box. And the idea of being on a journey and opening up a book like this, for many people, a lot of these sources or a lot of these ideas are going to be new. And to realize that it's okay to go on that journey and to go to a different place. And maybe at one point, this was a good schema for us, but now another is going to be helpful. I'm always coming back to, in my own mind, I thought this was, at least to me, one of the most powerful reflections on the life of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was that in the hesped that Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, Lahavdil Ben Chaim L'Chaim, she gave a magisterial hesped for Rav Lichtenstein. But one of the things that she described there, which I thought was so extraordinary, of a man who was one of the most accomplished intellectual giants in the Jewish world in the 20th century, was that the last Shabbos that he had at home, in his context, he was surrounded by a few Talmidim singing with him at Shal Shuvas. And she remarked about the journey that he took over his lifetime, which was primarily and fundamentally moored and rooted in a very intellectual tradition, but ultimately over time, how Rav Lichtenstein, who you could imagine being the most fixed in that world of the Beis Medrash of the intellectual, he took a journey over time to the point where she recognized at the end of his journey, he seemed to come to a place of wholeness with his Talmidim singing Zmiras to the point where he was kind of part in this world and part in the next world. And the idea that we need sometimes, you could use a halachic, an halachic term called a matir, a license. People feel like, you know, you talk in the book about that lahatir versus iser. People feel like, I'm stuck, I'm held back. This is the frame, this is what I was taught, this is what I learned in fourth grade or sixth grade, which may have been good at that time. But sometimes we need a license to go on a journey. And I think to me, that's the first takeaway when we open doors for new ideas, is the license to say, it's okay to go on a journey. It's okay to explore that new thing. And then, you know, everything unfolds from there. So that was kind of my first takeaway. But that brings back, of course, to this whole idea that it's all about relationships. And that's really the premise of the book.
Yeah. But I'm with you 100%. I think it's really the most important thing. It's a big passion of mine. I don't know. I think maybe I write in there somewhere. I think if you ever think, well, what's your favorite personality trait? Like what's a personality trait that endears you the most? Mine personally is curiosity. I love curiosity. Like, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It's the, I think the Yerushalmi says this, maybe other sources, that if you look at the words MS, truth versus sheker, falsehood, heard this before, that sheker, shin, kuf, resh, the three letters in the alphabet are next to each other. They're all very, it's very narrow. It's very boxed, as you said, right next to each other. But MS, aleph, is the very first letter, mem is the very middle letter, and tough is the very last letter. And because truth is spread out. Truth doesn't have a box. Truth is something that you, one moment I'm over here, and then a few years later, that's not where I am anymore. And it doesn't mean that it's disqualified. It means that it's part of shaping who I've become. But now I'm at tough. I'm at the complete opposite side of the spectrum. And then a month later, I'm at mem. I'm in the middle somewhere, and it keeps oscillating. It keeps moving in that way.
So let's talk about the relationship side. For some of us, this is very unfamiliar. What does it mean to think about a relationship with Hashem? How do you explain that to someone for whom that idea is totally foreign?
I have no idea.
When we got married, I'll give you a second to think so you can think while I'm talking. Not that you haven't thought about this, maybe.
No, I mean, that's literally the topic of the book, exactly. But I still feel like I don't know how to answer the question.
So I still remember.
So go buy the book. No. It's a great plug, right?
When we got married on a Thursday night in August, which you likely remember because when we got married in Miami, there was a humongous blackout all across the Northeast. It was August of 2003. So some of you remember that there was no power. So because of that, Rav Schechter Shalita and the Rebbetzin, they got stuck with us for Shabbos Sheva Brachos, which was fantastic. It was amazing. So I still remember at Shabbos lunch, after my mother-in-law asked him at the table if there's a segula to eat the challah. So he told her it's a segula to get fat if you eat too much challah. So then he told us at Sheva Brachos when he spoke at Shabbos lunch, he said that the parallel between a couple is the same way that we think about a relationship with Hashem. And he quoted Gemara in Brachos, the pasuk Gam Eile Tishkachna Va'Anochi Lo Eshkacheich. He said that the Ribbono Shel Olam, when he looks at us and he remembers many things, and certain things he just carefully forgets them. So he said to me, I don't think you need to tell this to the Chava, but he said to me, he said, there are certain things that you have to remember, but there are certain things as you go through life in a relationship that you should forget. You know, this person, maybe they neglected this or they over, you know. So that was his point when we got married. And that stuck with me all these years, the idea that the same way that I have a relationship with my wife, with a spouse, with a best friend, with a family member I'm close with, that's the model for a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but I can't hold back. The what Rav Schechter said to you is actually Rabbi Nachman writes that forgetfulness, people think, he says, I forgot the exact Lashon, Josh, maybe you remember the exact Lashon, that the Ha'olam Choshvim, the world thinks that Shichacha is a Davar Ra, I'm paraphrasing, that forgetfulness is a negative trait. But he says, Etzli, but by me, Shichacha hu Davar Tov, forgetting is a good thing. And he says, if I remember correctly, or maybe this is my own read, but I think he actually kind of subtly gives two reasons. Number one is what you just mentioned, which he says is because if a person always remembers everything. You can hear me in the back? Is that okay? Yeah. If a person always remembers everything they did, they can never live with themselves, which is really the same idea. If you remember everything that someone else close to you did, you couldn't, it'd be very hard. You have to be able to forgive, to move forward. And so forgetfulness can be helpful with that a little bit. That's number one. And number two is, and this is why I want to bring it up, is because what we were just talking about. Because he says the gift of forgetfulness is that every time now that you encounter it, it's new again. So people think, oh, you know, if I remember the Gemara so well, or if I remember the book I read, or I remember this poem, or I remember what the lecture I heard, so that's good. I want to remember it because we're looking at it from the place of wanting to have that information. But if you engage it or approach it from a more experiential place, then actually the forgetfulness is a mila. It's good because now I get to listen to this shir, or I get to read this poem or whatever it is as if it's the first time, which adds a whole level of excitement.
I mean, just on that point, it's the question of whether or not this is about information or it's about knowledge.
Right.
Is it about content or is it about a process? Moshe kibol Torah miSinai. Moshe didn't get Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That would have been the passing over of the information. He got the Torah from Sinai, meaning he got the Torah from the experience of being at the mountain with the Ashan, the Anan. It was the experience. That, and then the Mesira is the experience, it's the knowledge, not the information. If you have the information, download it.
Right. Okay, so to your question about what does it mean to have a relationship with Hashem, so I'll answer it along the lines of what we've just been talking about, which is how things change all the time. So I have no idea what I would answer in 5 minutes from now or what I would have answered an hour ago, but I'll make something up right now. I think what it means to me in this very moment, and I mean that literally as in this very moment, what it means to me to have a relationship with Hashem is that Judaism, which I'm going to use as the way that God is being manifest into my life, the way that God is speaking to me, the way Hashem is speaking to me is through the mitzvos and the Torah and the meaning and the values of Judaism. That Judaism is speaking to what I'm actually experiencing in a human way. So that it's not just an assortment of concepts or values or morals or spiritual ideas, but that it's actually relating to what's going on for me in a very raw way. So what emotional experience am I having right now? What am I going through in my life right now? So if I have a relationship with Hashem, that means that whatever I'm going through in my life right now, Hashem is going through that with me. Hashem is with me in that experience, whether it's a painful experience or a joyous experience, whether it's a fear, it's an anxiety, it's a happiness, it's a celebration, it's a hopelessness or a hopefulness, whatever it is, it's that actual human experience. And I think, to me, this is a piece that I think is not always so focused on. To me, it's almost like a missing link in a lot of Jewish education, in a lot of different settings, in that there's beautiful ideas spoken about, but it's still different than the relationship piece for me. The relationship piece is what am I actually experiencing right now, and the consciousness and the felt sense that Hashem is in that experience with me. Now, what does that mean practically? It means thinking about it. It means consciously thinking about it. I think it means feeling it, and it means speaking to Hashem in the things that I do. So on the drive over here, asking Hashem to help me find the right words, right? In what I'm feeling, thinking that Hashem is here with me in the feeling, in the celebration, in the pain, whatever it might be. But it's the genuine raw experience of where I actually am, as opposed to kind of ideas out there. Maybe that's the beginning of what I think it means to have a relationship with Hashem. That it's bringing it more into the human, to the inside of the human experience. I think that in previous times and previous generations, the world and especially the Jewish people were experiencing and suffering a lot more external challenges and suffering, things outside of us, right? A lot. And so the teachers of Judaism, whoever they were, the rabbis, people who wrote Svarim, whatever it was, was going to write
and teach ideas that spoke to those challenges. So they were external challenges, so the ideas were more external ideas. We certainly have external suffering still in the world, there's no question about that. But in many, many ways, we have a lot less than the world used to have. And so we actually have, I think, this is just an anecdotal theory, is a theory, I don't know if it's true, that as the external kind of existential suffering has gone down, for the fight for my existence, literally, has gone down, our inner problems have gone up. Right? Because now we're not as worried about where am I getting my next meal, or am I literally going to survive the next day, or who's going to barge into my house and who knows what's going to happen. So there's less of those external problems, and I think that's why, as a world, we are seeing an increase in more mental health type challenges, internal struggles. Because we actually have space for that now, right? It's kind of like a blessing and a curse in one. Which means that the Judaism of today needs to shift from speaking to those external challenges, and it needs to shift now to speak to the internal challenges. And so everything we learn about, I think, has to be, to really speak to us, has to be translated into that inner life of what I'm really experiencing. And so to me, that's, I think, the opening.
So part of what I'm hearing, if I'm hearing it correctly, is that there is a me, there is an I. I'm having an experience. I, as a person, as an individual, am having this experience. I'm an olam mali, I'm a whole world, and that I'm experiencing that together with the Ribono Shel Olam. But that the premise of this is that I'm aware of myself, my humanity, my challenges, my ups and my downs, and that my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to what's happening in my world. And if we realize that is the premise of the relationship, and that's a window to look at Judaism, we can understand many aspects of Chazal that maybe we didn't think about before. The Gemara says in the end of Psachim that in the end of days, there's going to be a big Suda, and there's going to be a cup for benching, and there are going to be debates at the table whether Avraham Avinu should bench or Yitzchak should bench. The Gemara ultimately lands that David HaMelech is going to bench. Hekim Ulashal Tshuva Kos Yeshuas Esa. So what is it about David HaMelech that distinguishes him from the Avos? So there are many, many aspects, but I think the notion that you see through Sefer Tehillim is the humanity of David HaMelech. The Bechina of Malchus, which is obviously central and core to what you're talking about when you think about the Torah, you could say, of Panemius, the Torah that so many of us need and are attached to today, is that Torah that relates to a person's humanity. The David HaMelech Torah, the Kos Yeshuos Sesa, that a person struggles, they fall down, and then they pick themselves back up. And they get closer, and then they ultimately fall back. So thinking about Judaism through the lens of David HaMelech, through the lens of being human, perhaps is the first step in a relationship with Hashem. But if a person sees themselves in a fixed way that's devoid of the reality that is humanity and life, so then how are you going to have a relationship? That's right, not right. Isn't that the premise?
Yeah, that's so good. That's such a good way of putting it. I love that. David HaMelech. And it's so true, right? You read Tehillim, like nobody expresses the human experience in the way David does. And it's not ideas, right? Tehillim's not ideas. It's just a raw, vulnerable human experience. That's great. And that's Malchus. I never thought about that. That's really good. And I think that's true because So a lot of what the book is based on is taking concepts from relationships in a marriage relationship and kind of seeing that as a paradigm of understanding how we can have a relationship with Hashem. So if you think about a marriage, a marital relationship, so on the one hand, there's a tension, right? There's kind of a dialectic, if you will, because on the one hand, relationships really require dependency. They require a vulnerability, a willingness to be dependent on another person, to experience an amount of self in which I can't be self-sufficient, I can't figure it all out on my own, I can't live completely on my own, that I actually need another person. This is why America is not very good at relationships, because America has, for a long time now, put self-sufficiency as the ultimate value, the ultimate thing we're striving for. But self-sufficiency is fundamentally at odds with having a relationship. Like, it's this big, like, mystery of why is, you know, Western society struggling with relationship? Because, well, it's very simple. It's not simple, but it's the very value that you placed at the top of the value hierarchy is fundamentally mutually exclusive with having relationships. Relationship means I need another person. Self-sufficiency means I don't need another person. So you value self-sufficiency means it's mutually exclusive with having relationships. Now, it can't be mutually exclusive. There needs to be somehow that they come together. But the idea is that relationships require that I'm actually okay being dependent. I see dependency as a good thing. One of the leading therapists now in the world of attachment theory and couples counseling is someone named Dr. Sue Johnson. So she writes in one of her books, she writes that the Western culture sees dependency as a dirty word, and that's the fundamental source of the breakdown of stable and meaningful relationships, because we actually need each other all the time. It's inevitable that we need each other. The question is just how much are we in denial of that? How much do we try and avoid that? Or how much do we actually intentionally and willingly lean into that? That we actually need each other. It's a good thing to need each other. And we deeply need each other. We need each other in technical, practical ways, and we need each other in deep, emotional, existential ways. We're not okay being alone. We're not okay being self-sufficient. The height of career success, of being some entrepreneur who made it completely on their own, that on their own status leads to the downfall of a person's satisfaction and health and happiness. So we really need another person. We need that dependency. At the same time, everything you just said is true. Because if there's this focus now in the world on self-care, right? On developing your own sense of self, on spending time with yourself. In Chassidus and in Musar, there's a lot of focus on hispodidus, on spending time alone. And there's this emphasis on being able to be okay on your own. And you have self-esteem, in that you can esteem yourself, you can feel good within yourself, self-acceptance and self-love. So that would seem to be at odds with the dependency I just talked about, right? And the reality is that in relationships, what research shows is that people who are completely on the dependent side and their relationships become enmeshed. So if you imagine a relationship as the two individuals are two circles and the two circles are overlapping each other, or one is subsumed within the other, so then it's enmeshed and you don't have a relationship. I'll get back to that in a second. On the other side, if you have overly self-sufficient, you have two circles that are not even touching or overlapping, and you just have roommates or business partners. And what we want to have is two circles that look like a Venn diagram, right? So there's a part that's overlapping and there's a part that's on the outside. Why does there need to be that part on the outside? Because of what you're saying. Because if I don't have a sense of self, then I'm not actually in a relationship. Because then there's not two, a relationship is two people being dependent on one another. But if I don't have any of my own beliefs, any of my own thoughts, my own ideas, my own interests, my own opinions, my own hobbies, then there is no person validating my wife. There's no person there validating her. It's just her. There is no relationship. There's no one for her to be dependent on, and there's no one being dependent upon her, and vice versa. So if there's no sense of self, so if it's going back to the human and God relationship now, if there's only Hashem, there's only learning Torah in the way of focusing on Hashem, and there's no understanding of myself, there's no I first, so then there's no relationship with Hashem. There's just Hashem. There's no relationship because it's just the ideas of the mitzvos, of Torah, of Hashem. There needs to be an I first so that Hashem can actually be relating to the being that's me, that now there's actually a relationship.
Just to clarify, this is not a contradiction to Ein Od Milvado. Of course, the Ribbono Shel Olam chooses to create the opportunity for us to have that.
Yeah,
right?
100%. Yeah.
Just nobody should confuse.
Yes, yeah. But there needs to be, in order for it to be a relationship, there needs to be that awareness of self first. And then I'm bringing Hashem into that awareness, into that experience.
So I want to circle back to something you alluded to earlier. And I'm only comfortable sharing this preamble because I recently was in New Jersey and I had a chance to talk briefly with Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger Shlita. And I asked him about this therapist. And he said, yes, fascinating idea. And a lot of the things that she writes and some of the topics of her books and works are guess you could say, slightly beyond what I would normally be comfortable with.
I think I already can guess.
You know where I'm going with this. There is a very prominent therapist. Her name is Esther Perel. Fascinating woman. And she has amazing ha'aras. So I was discussing one particular ha'ara with Rabbi Neuberger, and I was delighted that he was very into it. Mm. He's very into a lot of what Esther Perel teaches. So I thought that was fascinating. So once he said it was okay, I just didn't say it in a public setting. So she has this ha'ara, which I was discussing with him, which you alluded to earlier, and I was curious if you wanted to expand on it a little bit about how we can experience Yahadus, not so much in the book, but maybe just Baal Peh, because it doesn't, it's related, but I'm curious to hear you talk about it. She talks about the oscillation you talked about before between stability and novelty. Mm-hmm. Esther Perel does a lot of work with couples who have infidelity. So one of the things that she talks about is that when someone has an affair, what they're looking for very often, not always, but one of the things they're looking for is novelty. And they're looking for something new and different. And this balance in all aspects of life. So when I first heard this yisod from her, I'm like, that is really interesting to think about in our relationship with the Rebbe Shlom and the way that the Rebbe Shlom gives us the channels you talked about earlier in terms of Torah and mitzvahs that oscillate between that stability, the fixed, feeling that we're comfortable and that we've got something that's stable, and at the same time, being creative and adventurous and spontaneous. So how would you reflect on that, if you want on that aspect of relationship, that dynamic, and how it relates to persons of Avodas Hashem.
Yeah, I think this is a great example also of not being in the box, because if we were box-like thinkers, I don't think we should focus on Esther Perel. But we're not box-like thinkers, so we can take pieces of what she says that actually are great, and not have to take all of it. Right? We can find MS by taking sparks of pieces from different places. So I actually think it's a really great piece to think about. So I think that historically or generally speaking in the world, tell me if you agree with this, in the world there's kind of two extremes, which is with regards to this question or this topic. One is kind of what we would think of as like an old school approach, right? Stop asking questions, do your job, you know, do what you're supposed to do, and stop like, you know, looking for inspiration and meaning. Like, that's not what it's about. If it's supposed to come, it'll come. La'olam yilmad adam shelo lishma, mino shelo lishma ba lishma. Just do what you're supposed to do, and the rest is going to follow and supposed to come. And zehu, we're done, right? That's kind of a, we think of as like an old school approach. Then, I think there's a very new school approach, which is the second I'm done with something, the second I'm bored of my phone, I'll get a new phone. The second I'm, you know, not interested in the paint color in my house, I'll repaint my house. The second that things are so easily expendable and easily, you know, recyclable that we can just go through, you know, okay, so I wore these shoes for one winter and now I'm going to get a new pair for the next winter, right? It's just, things are so much more accessible. And so that creates a whole, you know, mundane things are like that, right? But because mundane things are like that, that's how I think we start orienting and relating to the more significant and deeper things too, even like relationships. So if I'm used to 98% of the things in my life being so recyclable, like my shoes and my sweater and the paint color and my kitchen and my car and whatever it is, then I'm going to relate to more significant things like that too, which is, I think, hugely problematic. So those are two extremes that I think are both flawed. I think what Judaism brings is a middle approach, which is kind of a synthesis, which really relates to the way we started this conversation, which is, the idea in Judaism is we want to actually do both of those things at the same time, I think. What we're trying to do is say, we're going to do the same thing again and again and again, but within the same thing, it's going to be new each time. That's novel. That is, I think, a much more subtle and sophisticated approach that I don't think you hear about all the time. I think we hear a kind of pendulation from one extreme to the other of the two sides that I just said. Either be quiet and do what you're supposed to do. That's like half of like the societal voice. And then the other half is, no, but what about what I'm interested in? What about what's meaningful to me? What about my voice? And that's like the other side of the pendulation. We swing back and forth between these two sides. But Lanias Daiti, I think that what Yiddishkeit is really about is saying, here's what we're supposed to be. It's the same thing. every year, we're about to have Pesach, right? Every year Pesach is the same, but every year Pesach is completely different. Within the same thing, it's completely different. That's why maybe, I don't know if my grandmother, who's a Hebrew, this was actually in the book, and I took it out because she said she didn't think it was true. But I still think B'derech Drash, it could be true. Just, I won't send her this recording. The word for year in Hebrew is Shana, which Lishanot means to repeat, to cycle. But it's very similar to the word Shinoi, which means to change. Literally the same word, to repeat and to change. Now she told me they're not the same shoresh, so it's not a good word.
But I think in Gemara language it is true.
It could be.
In Kachin, when you say Shana Olav HaKasav La'akev or Shina Olav HaKasav La'akev,
right,
I think that
right.
is used interchangeably. So you can tell, so I'll tell Zvachim, we might use it.
So it's not a coincidence, right, that those words are so interconnected. To repeat and to change are within the same thing. Or similarly, Shana, which means cycle, but what's a Shana made up of? Chadashim, which chadash means new. So within the same old, there's a new again. And I think it loops back to the beginning of being on a journey, right? Being in a place of traveling, of moving, of seeing it new again, but from within the same thing. And I think that ultimately that actually leads to a life that's, if we're on the side that's just do what you're supposed to do and move on, it's obviously missing. And on the other side, which society has swung to the opposite extreme, I think is also equally problematic. It's just problematic in another way, but I don't think it's actually any better because it creates complete instability in every regard. And that middle approach is really what I think it's all about. And I think it's always really been what authentic Judaism has been trying to teach, is that every time, not every time, obviously, it's not going to change every single time, but on a constant basis, we're renewing what the very same practices, with the very same actions, the very same places, the very same times of the year, they're the same on the outside, but the inner meaning of what they mean to me in that moment is going to renew itself again and again.
So isn't that really at the core of what a relationship is about? So you take the matzah, for example, the pu'ula, the action of eating matzah, it's the same. But what differs from year to year is the kavana, the intention. It's the hachana, the preparedness. It's the thought. It's the orientation.
Yeah.
That experience of it is what's different. Mm-hmm. So you can live with another person, whether it's a spouse or a best friend, or, you know, you can go through the motions, but what the relationship is about is the thoughts. I came across recently a wild maisa. Remember that book, Tuesdays with Maury?
Mm-hmm.
So Mitch Albums, he writes this book about, and then I came across recently a maisa that this guy, Maury, had another friend also, I don't know, it's Hashkacha, his name was Maurice, so they were good friends. So Maury was becoming ill, lo alein, it was very, you know, clear. And his best friend, Maurice, was starting to lose his hearing. So the interviewer, I forget what network it was on, said to Maurice, what's going to be when he continues to degenerate and you can't even hear anything? So he said, we're just going to hold hands and the friendship and love is going to go back and forth between us.
Wow.
Meaning the pu'ula is just a hechitimtza, right. It's just a mechanism to create. Like the word mitzvah, it's from the word savsa, to pair up. The mitzvah is just an excuse. It's an action that can pair us up on the inside, and on the heart level, on the machshava level, on the heart level, with Rabbanu Shalom.
Right.
So I think that really helps us. If you want to take something practical from, if I'm understanding correctly, what Rabbi Danishevsky is pointing out here, is that when you do a mitzvah, whatever that's going to be, whether it's lighting Shabbos candles, or eating matzah, or giving tzedakah, we view that as an action, a concrete action, which is fixed, which is familiar to us, which is stable, but it's really a vehicle to create an inner awareness and an inner connection to Hashem. And that awareness is constantly refreshed. There's the hischachos.
And I think the way that we access the ongoing renewal of what it means on the inner level is what we were talking about before, which is that I'm looking for the Torah to relate to what's going on for me. So what's going on in my life right now is incredibly different than what was going on in my life a year ago on Pesach and the year before that. So if the way I'm relating to the Torah and to Hashem is from first, like you said before, first by knowing myself and then allowing the Torah to speak to me, so then it's naturally going to be different each time because what I'm going through right now is completely different. Each week to week, Shabbos comes in and it's about being able to feel complete with the world. Okay, but each week as Shabbos comes in, the area in which I feel so deeply incomplete is going to be different. And so when Shabbos comes in, that means it's the same Shabbos, but it's different because it's speaking to a different aspect of my feeling incomplete and bringing in that opportunity or that work of how to accept and how to be in a place of feeling completion even when it's not complete.
And the key of what you're describing is that the Torah gave us the framework. If we were right. just told, go be spiritual, right. so then we would have no context.
Right.
We wouldn't have tools. But if it's just about the tools. So you alluded to before something you left out of the book, attributed to your grandmother. Is there a particular favorite piece that speaks to you right now more than a different part of the book that that you're really attached to?
Well, I'll see if something comes to me. I'll tell you in the meantime a more of a humorous story. So I tried to get for the book a haskama. In the beginning, like a note of kind of recommendation from Rav Asher Weiss Shlita, and if you look at the book, you'll notice there is not one, unfortunately.
Not yet.
But here's the story. So I had a friend bring him a manuscript to ask on my behalf to ask for a haskama, and he told my friend Moshe Gersht actually. He told him. He said, "Tell the author that he shouldn't change anything, but I can't give it a haskama. Why?" He said, because one of the chapters is called Is God a Narcissist? And he said, I can't put a haskam on a book that says that, but people need it to say that, so don't change it. Now, the reason this story is so frustrating is because I changed it, but I still don't have the haskama. So it was a lose-lose, because I couldn't go back to him again, but I changed it because it was too strong. So I changed it to Is God too perfect? Obviously my answer was no, God is not a narcissist, but I was trying to catch something, but I think it was a little too strong, so I changed it, but ended up without the catchy title and without the haskama. But I don't think anything, there's a lot that's not in it, obviously. There's more that's not in it than is in it. But I don't have any like great answer for something specific that was in it that got taken out.
Is there something that speaks to you right now in the book? Because when you wrote the book, it was a long process.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm really
ago, yeah, yeah.
So that's what I'm really curious about. Is there something that you feel connected to and attached to in the book right now that maybe when you wrote it wasn't as resonant?
Well, I'll tell you, I'll answer kind of the opposite, and then maybe I'll come back to it in a second. The thing that I think is missing from the book the most, which I'm thinking about maybe trying to start writing another as like a sequel to this, is what I spoke about before about dependency. I don't think I focused enough on that, and I think that is really the core and the source of how we develop attachments and relationships, is that the openness to dependency, knowing our own dependency. I allude to it, but I don't really focus on it and how to develop that. I think that's really... it's really missing in the book, because that really is the opening to relationships. It's the willingness and the valuing of dependency, as opposed to a kind of begrudging, unfortunate circumstance that sometimes I need to be dependent on somebody. And flipping that to, no, dependency is actually an ideal. I actually look for dependency. I have, along with the book, we started a podcast. So the second episode of the podcast that's not out yet, one of the series in the podcast is I bring on different speakers and have a conversation with them about different topics that come up. So the first episode, which is out, is a conversation I had with Rabbi Shlomo Katz. The second one, which is not out yet, is from someone, Dr. Daniel Gottlieb, who is a psychologist, amazing person. He's kind of like an old hero of mine that I reached out to thinking there was no way he was going to answer me, and he answered and was very kind and willing to do an episode with me. He wrote a book called Letters to Sam that I've kind of been in love with for a really long time.
I saw it in the book.
In the book, yeah, I quote it. So he is a psychologist who got in a terrible car accident about 30 years ago and became paralyzed from the neck down completely. And he then later had a grandson who was born with autism. And he wrote him a book. He was written a number of books, but this is the book that like caught me years ago. I've read it many times, called Letters to Sam. Sam is his grandson. He wrote a series of letters to his son, to his grandson, Sam. So in the episode, which hopefully you'll all subscribe and then you'll see when this comes out, in the episode that I had with him, he said to me this most amazing thing. He said, in some ways, obviously I wish I didn't have this situation, But on the other hand, I feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world, because I get to see the kind side of the world in a way that most people don't get to see. So because I'm in a wheelchair, or I'm in a little, I forgot what he called it, whatever, like a little, and he said, when people are standing by a door and they see me, they will always hold it for longer than they would for somebody else. When people see me and they're in the middle of being argumentative about who's first in line and someone's impatient or road rage, and they see me, it always softens instantaneously. That. All the anger, all the fierceness, all the impatience, all the aggressiveness, somebody sees me and it softens. Why? Because my vulnerability is more explicit. And he said, I'm not actually more dependent or vulnerable than anybody else. We are all completely, profoundly, and fundamentally vulnerable and dependent on everybody else. Just everybody else is able to hide their vulnerabilities. I can't hide mine. But we are all wired when we see vulnerability to soften. So anywhere I go, I get to see the soft side of the world. He said, you, Yaakov, you go somewhere, you don't get to see the soft side of the world. So I'm the luckiest person because I automatically bring out people's vulnerabilities.
That's fascinating.
Dependency and vulnerability is the opening of relationships. And I didn't write about that a lot in there. So that would be the piece that's not in there.
So I think maybe that's a great place to wrap up a little bit. Tefillah, which you touch on in the book, maybe in light of that, it makes sense why for so many of us, especially for teenagers, Rav Asher Weiss doesn't have to give us gum to this, but can I say that tefillah is a disaster?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
On a substantive level for many of us many
yes.
times?
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's part of identifying the challenge, that if we're in a culture that shies away from dependency, and, you know, just as Brené Brown, we're very uncomfortable with vulnerability. And we couple that with, thank God, tremendous affluence. So you take your average teenager who has a credit card and plenty of clothing and even a car, and you tell them, yeah, we'd like you to engage in a relationship that's predicated on dependency, mm-hmm. right? Let me know how that,
right?
How does that go? Right. So what is a way that we can now realize, in light of this idea of nurturing a relationship and the value of dependency, that tefillah is actually one of the greatest gifts that we can embrace in our life and that the Rebbe Shlomo gave us?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a little bit of a reformulated way of the well-known idea from the Rav, right? So there's a machlokas rishonim between the Rambam and the Ramban about how frequent is the mitzvah of davening, midaraisa? How much is davening, is prayer considered to be rooted in an actual mitzvah from the Torah, and how much is it rabbinic? So the Rambam says that it's midaraisa, it's from the Torah every day to daven. The Ramban says that it's only a mitzvah min haTorah, from the Torah level, to daven when a person's in a state of crisis. That's the debate. Rav Soloveitchik has an idea that he developed that maybe they're not arguing about whether or not what we'd call the machayev, the impetus, the cause of prayer is to be in distress. Everyone agrees that what causes prayer, what creates the need to pray, is distress. The Ramban says that it's referring only to distress that is acute distress, in the sense that it's practical distress. So if you're in a situation of distress, you're in danger, so then you have a mitzvah to daven. But if you don't, then there's no mitzvah to daven. But the Rambam, on the other hand, the Rav suggests, would agree that the machayev, the cause of prayer, is distress, but it's not limited to practical related distress. It can be even existential distress. And how often are we in existential distress? 100% of the time. And therefore, there's a mitzvah to daven every day. That's what the Rav says for the Rambam. Personally, I've always thought, I'm not sure, because the pasuk that the Rambam brings as the makor for davening is la'avdu b'chol levavchem, which is a very different, but I don't know, maybe it still is, I'm not sure. Anyway, so that's Rav Soloveitchik's idea. But I thought from this lens of what we're talking about now, we can, really the same thing as what the Rav said, I'm just kind of reformulating it slightly. Maybe if we look at it as dependency instead of distress, which are really the same thing, but it's a slightly different formulation.
It's a different affect. Not all of us can live like the Rav with existential angst all at the same time.
It's a different, it's a different feel.
It's a little tense for
it.
Most of us. I mean, maybe for some of us. For some of us, it's okay. If your name is not Soloveitchik, then we have to figure some out.
Right. So you're right. It's a different affect. There's a different feel to it. So the way I want to formulate the same idea as the Rav, but formulate it slightly different angle that I think, like you said, is a little bit more shavel chol nefesh. I think it speaks to people, is to think about it from the lens of dependency. What and the need for relationship. What the Ramban is saying maybe is that, of course, it's always a good thing to lean into dependency and to daven, but there's a mitzvah in a Torah to daven, because davening is how we lean into that dependency when there's a practical dependent need that you have. There's some tangible need, a concrete need that you have from Hashem, so then there's a mitzvah to daven. But maybe what the Rambam is saying, based on the Rav's ideas, the Rambam is not fundamentally disagreeing with that. The Rambam is just expanding that. And what the Rambam is saying is that we are all fundamentally in a constant state of dependency. Because even if we have no distress in a practical, tangible way at that moment, we need relationship. We need to live life in a way that we feel seen and that we're seeing another, that we feel that we're being known and that we're knowing the other, that we're living our experience in this world in a shared experience with someone else. And ultimately that being that we can share our experience in this world with, that we can be dependent on, because dependency means that I don't have to have any practical need. I don't have to need some sort of business relationship with you, or you take care of these things and I take care of these things. My need for you is just the need of relationship. It's relationship for the sake of relationship. That's what attachment theory is about. It's that children and adults need relationships, not just because the parent can be a caregiver, but they can be a caregiver because they can be a caregiver. Not because they're, you know, providing food, but they're a caregiver, literally giving care. It's the relationship. And adults have essentially all the same needs, that we need each other. We need to live life in a shared experience. And that's constant. And so that maybe is what davening is for the Rambam, which is why it's actually every day.
And so the dependency is actually a means to realizing the relationship, right? Davening, yeah. Of course, the core of it is asking, bakasha, but really, according to many, davening is milashon, tefillah is milashon psil, bound, attached.
Right. Yeah. And it's on Shabbos, seal. We actually can't even...
And you can't even ask for
you can't,
Shabbos.
Right, but there's still the same mitzvah. So because it's about the connection.
It's about that. It's about that relationship. All right, we are definitely out of town, but maybe you just close with a word on the cover, because it's so beautiful and a great way to close. So I want to thank everybody for coming. Thank the Pinchots for hosting. Thank Rabbi Danishevsky. And maybe just give us the beautiful insight on the cover.
Thank you, everyone, for listening and for the great questions and comments. The cover, just really quickly. So I was trying to find some sort of image that could possibly portray or represent the idea of attachment to God, but how do you do that in a picture? And I spent a long time just scrolling and found this one, and instantly it was like, this is the one. And I'll just very quickly mention why it really spoke to me, other than the fact that I think it's beautiful art, but it spoke to me just really quickly. Number one, because I think that attachment to Hashem, and what we were talking about before, has to come from within the world. When we try and find God outside of the world in some mystical, spiritual idea, that's not really what Judaism is about. That's not really what relationship with Hashem is about. It's really about being in this world. And so I love how the pillar of smoke is like from within the house. It like, you see it emanating from the chimney. It's from like the mundane, from the day-to-day basic being in this world. And it extends upwards. And so it's this connection between the world and the heavens, and somehow in that way. Number two is that if you look at the original studies of attachment theory, some of the studies they first did on attachment theory were using little monkeys, and they set up, I won't go into the details, but they set up an experiment of one kind of fake caregiver that provided food and one fake caregiver that provided warmth. And who would the monkey go to in a time of distress? So they would always go to the food for food. But when they needed someone, when they were dependent, who would they go to? So everyone thought they would go to the food because that's where they're used to going to, the wire food provider. But they would always go to the warm provider. And the picture of this study is a monkey that is literally like this little monkey with his arms wrapped around this like furry little, you know, I don't know, pillow type thing, and clutching it. And that's attachment, like clutching it. And this individual in the painting is clutching that pillar of smoke. And the pillar of smoke is Ashan, and there's a teaching, which I won't go into now, but I'll just mention it. This is the last reason the painting was really significant to me. By the way, I spoke to the artist. The painting has an entirely different meaning than what his intention was. None of these things crossed his mind. His intention is actually also really interesting, but I won't. I know I'm talking too much, so I'll stop. But the Sefer Yetzirah says that Hashem is found in the world through Olam Shana Nefesh. Olam is in places. We find Hashem in different places. Shana is different times, and Nefesh is different people. And Ayin Shin Nun, Olam Shana Nefesh, is the acronym of Ashan. And that's rooted in Har Sinai Ashan Kulo. By the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, it filled with smoke from God's presence. And that smoke unfolded, God's presence unfolds into this world in these three dimensions. And so he's holding on to the smoke because that's how Hashem's presence becomes revealed into our lives through this world, through time, space, and people. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.